Hello and welcome to ESIB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Frederick Eriksson, and today I am joined by my colleague, Oscar Guinea, to talk about transatlantic economic performance and transatlantic economic relations, especially in light of the upcoming Transatlantic Trade and Technology Summit now in April. Oscar, you've been following the development of the TTC, as it's called, over the last years. Can you paint us a picture of what it is and whether this initiative has been useful and delivered meaningful results?
Yes, of course, and thanks for having me. So the EU and the US Trade and Technology Council is actually a forum. It is a space created in June 2021 for EU and US policymakers to meet, to discuss, and to try to come up with plans, initiatives, and agreements that help them achieve whatever common goal they have. So the TTC has had five main areas of work, which are export controls, foreign direct investment, screening, secure supply chains, technology standards, and global trade challenges. And in order to achieve the common goals in these five areas, the EU and the US have established 10 working groups. The work done by civil servants in these working groups is steered at the political level to provide leadership over the main priorities. So when the EU commissioners and the US Secretary of State meet, they can show some results. And there have been some concrete outcomes out of the TTC. So we can mention some wins in artificial intelligence, in additive manufacturing, the standardization of charges for electric vehicles, and an agreement of good manufacturing practices for veterinary medicine. But I think everyone will agree that there is a gap between the grand titles of the working group areas and the working groups and the actual deliverables. And I think it's good to have a forum for discussion. That's a positive development. And for instance, when China announced controls on the exports of gallium and germanium, the TTC activated an early warning for semiconductor supply chains disruption. So it's actually working. But I think it's also fair to say that there were high expectations at the beginning of the TTC, and these expectations have been tempered over time.
All right. And I think that begs the question, so what were the expectations?
I think the expectations, we have to go back to 2021, and both the EU and the US were kind of facing the competitive challenge from China, and they both politicians at both sides of the Atlantic came to an agreement and felt that they needed to come together in order to agree on plans to face these challenges.
Mm-hmm. So basically, changes in the world which prompts new forms of collaboration between the old transatlantic partners. I can see that point. So, but looking ahead now towards the summit, so what's on the agenda now for the April summit?
Well, I think the agenda is similar to the previous meetings. It will be about reporting, about taking stock of the ongoing work by the working groups and so on. I mean, judging by the press releases put up by the EU and the US, it's all pretty bland, referring to review progress, identify new areas for collaboration, deepen the transatlantic partnership. But underneath this uncommitted government speak, there's a lot of work done by civil servants in the 10 working groups on technology standards, on climate and clean technology, on export controls, and so on and so forth. So unfortunately, this work has not materialized yet into a hard commitments or agreements between the EU and the US that really harness the market power of both regions.
And I would assume that we're also in a, within quotation mark, interesting political time right now. We have Europe going into elections, in, for instance, European Parliament elections. And of course, we have the American election cycle gearing up as well with the presidential election in November. And do you think we should take into account these developments as we look at the TTC meeting now? I mean, it must be one of the last meetings before we really get into a hot political season in both America and Europe.
Absolutely. I think it will be unwise to think that these TTCs can go on as usual, because this could be the last TTC meeting. And in a sense, it's quite important that before we enter into this new political cycle that you have referred, the TTC and those working in the TTC, they need to come up with something that really shows the value of the forum as a way of delivering results.
Yeah, no, indeed. And Nadine, and I think we're probably past the time when both sides have to come up with results to demonstrate to their own electorates and, of course, to elected politicians that it is useful and that it's a format that can be delivered. But let's park that issue for the time being. And I want to take some time, Oscar, also to talk a little bit more about some deeper and specific initiatives here. You came up with a study a few months ago which looked at a trade initiative that could be taken in the TTC on standards and conformity assessments. Now, that's hardly subjects for headlines in newspapers, so it is bureaucratic and works pretty well with the type of focus and attention that they've had in these working groups. So what is the paper about, and why do you think this initiative is important?
So basically, in the study, we propose an agreement on conformity assessment between the EU and the US that covers machinery and electrical equipment. Now, before you start rolling your eyes and think, you know, this is a rather niche and technical topic, as you said.
I am rolling my eyes, yes.
You'll give me 5 minutes to try to convince you otherwise. So what we propose is pretty simple. So the EU and the US should allow firms in both countries to use third-party laboratories within the EU or the US to test the products before exporting them to each other's market. So basically, this will increase the number of viable conformity assessment bodies for EU and US firms, which is expected to reduce the cost and the time required to demonstrate conformity. This is a narrow deal in scope, but it's not a small deal. In 2022, the transatlantic trade in machinery and electrical equipment was equal to $192 billion. This is higher than what the EU and the US trade in pharmaceuticals, in vehicles, or in aircrafts. Now, if an agreement on conformity assessment between the EU and the US on machinery and electrical equipment achieves a reduction in trade costs between 2 and 6%, which is within the range of what the literature tells us this kind of agreement can achieve, US and EU trade is expected to increase between $25 billion and $75 billion. This is actually larger than the rise in trade flows achieved in free trade agreements signed by the EU and the US. And in addition to economic integration, there are two more reasons why the EU and the US should pursue this agreement. The first one is economic security, and the second one is lowering the cost of climate change policies. In relation to economic security, the EU and the US have been developing policies to reduce their dependencies from China. Well, it happens that China is the main provider of machinery and electrical equipment to both the EU and the US. Because this agreement on conformity assessment only benefits EU and US firms when exporting to each other, Chinese firms will experience a reduction in their exports to the EU and to the US, making the EU and the US less reliant on China. Second, because products belonging to machinery and electrical equipment are used across multiple clean technologies, from windmills to photovoltaic panels, a reduction in trade costs for these sectors will also lower the cost of the energy transition. And I have more benefits of the agreement. And a bonus of that, you have two additional advantages. The first one is that it doesn't cost any money to taxpayers. So basically, it achieves a reduction in Chinese dependency without resorting to any public subsidy. It uses market competition to improve economic security. And secondly, it doesn't require any change in EU and US regulation. It is simply a way of helping exporters to comply with regulation without getting into never-ending discussions about what regulatory model is better or how to achieve regulatory equivalence. So, this is great, but how can we achieve this? The good news is that the EU and the US already have an agreement on conformity assessment that dates back to 1998. The agreement has been updated to keep up with the pace of time, And at the moment, it includes sectors like telecommunication equipment, pharmaceutical products, or medical devices. So everything I have just described could be achieved by expanding this agreement to include machinery and electrical equipment.
All right. Well, I'm afraid, Oscar, I'm going to sound like this grumpy person that you meet when you're a salesman, and you come and you brandish and you talk up your product here, and I'm going to ask the smell test question, which is that, well, all right, if it's so good as you describe, why hasn't it been done before?
And my reply is, oh, that's a good question. And that's a question I ask myself. And basically, there's two reasons for that. The first one is because conformity assessment is compulsory for EU firms exporting to the US, but not so for US companies selling to the EU, where there is no need to demonstrate third-party conformity. And secondly, because the EU has had, and it has, but traditionally has had, a bilateral trade surplus with the US on machinery and electrical equipment. So US policymakers have been afraid of providing market access to EU firms that may hurt companies.
Right.
But there's the big but. These two arguments are much weaker now. First, the EU is passing more and more regulations requiring third-party conformity assessment, including for machinery. And now, this is good news for the third-party conformity assessment industry, but not so for US exporters. And therefore, US firms will make an increasing use of this agreement for sure. And the second reason is that it is actually Chinese companies, not the European ones, that really dominate global exports of machinery and electrical equipment, and also the EU and US imports.
All right. So a broad political economy shift, which has perhaps then changed political preferences, or at least they should change political preferences with regard to what you're proposing. All right. So let us now turn to economic performance, and we park the issue of transatlantic relations and the TTC. So I think it's fair to say that there has been a pretty strong interest in the variety in economic performance between Europe and America over the last couple of years. We've seen a lot of newspaper articles being written about it, and you and colleagues of ours have also published paper of it, about this issue. We know that there are always short-term cyclical trends, and in the past years, we've seen much faster growth in the United States compared to the EU. But I think it's also fair to say that this difference in growth rates had partly been driven by strong fiscal expansion in the United States. It's a country which is now running record high fiscal deficits. But if we would take more of a long-term view and consider economic performance over, say, two decades, what is it that we're going to find? Are there distinct trends here that make them alike or perhaps make them more different from each other? What do you say, Oscar?
Well, what we have found is that over time, the US has become more economically prosperous than the EU. And this is particularly noticeable after the financial crisis of 2008 and in the post-COVID recovery. Now, small differences in GDP per capita are not that significant for one particular year. But when this small differences accumulate over the long term, it results in obvious divergence in economic well-being. And the main driver of long-term economic prosperity is productivity. So to understand the divergence in economic prosperity, we need to compare EU and US productivity. Productivity is a simple concept. It is our ability to produce more output with fewer inputs. But it's not so straightforward to measure. We tend to use two indicators: labor productivity, which is the amount of output per worker, and total factor productivity, which measures changes in productivity that cannot be attributed to physical and human capital. So basically how efficient labor and capital is used in the production of goods and services. This includes changes in management models and innovations to generate new and better products. If we plot these two indicators, and compare the EU and the US over time, we find that in relation to labor productivity, the US shows higher levels and faster growth. And in relation to the contribution of total factor productivity to overall productivity growth, while falling in the EU and the US, total factor productivity is higher in America than in Europe.
All right. So I think a lot of people would find it difficult to... They may understand the concept of productivity and how it affects over time, but it's also a bit of a technical concept itself. So can you just help us to unpack that a bit and also explain on productivity the divergence between the EU and the United States? What are the different drivers that leads them to these different levels of productivity growth?
Sure. So as I was saying, productivity boils down to the idea of producing more and better products with fewer inputs. So a way to produce more and better products is to innovate. And we can measure innovation looking at what it goes inside the innovation machine, what is called the innovation inputs, and what the innovation machine produces, and is called the innovation outputs. An indicator of innovation inputs is expenditure in research and development. And US expenditure in research and development is 77% higher than in the EU. And this gap, which was already significant for some time, has widened over the years. An indicator of innovation output is the number of patents. And the number of technology patents filed in the US is not only higher than in the EU, but it has increased over time, while the growth in the number of technology patents in Europe has been flat. So that comes with innovation. A second driver of productivity is intangible capital. This is a bit of a basket category that includes everything from industrial designs and training programs to data sets and AI. Intangibles are important for two reasons. The first one is that these data sets and training programs are essential to use and diffuse innovation. If we look at investments in intangibles capital in the EU and the US, we can see that the US invested more as a share of its economy and has been doing this for longer than the EU. The second reason why intangibles are important is because many of the new technologies that we have now, for instance, all the large language models, are intangibles. So traditionally, new ideas on how to produce more and better products with less input used to come inside boxes and machines. Now they come in zeros and ones. And these new technologies and innovations are transmitted through the internet. So investments in digital infrastructure are also important because they enable the deployment of these new technologies. It is similar to the investments in roads for transport. We need good transport infrastructure for cars to drive faster and safer. So we need good ICT infrastructure to use and diffuse new technologies, which happens to be digitalized. And I think it's important that once the digital infrastructure is built, digital technologies can be implemented really fast. So let me give you a good example. It took 2 months for ChatGPT to reach 100 million users. As a comparison, Thomas Edison patented the light bulb in the 1880s, but it took between 20 and 40 years for electric lighting to become the standard for public lighting in most cities. And also in this case, in investments in ICT capital, it has been larger and it has been growing faster in the US than in Europe.
All right. So, I mean, you've been talking now about R&D expenditures like an input, patents as an output. We've been talking about intangible capital. I think a lot of people also would say, well, isn't just the American market more entrepreneurial and more dynamic in terms of its business sector? I mean, the ChatGPT example you took here, isn't basically every new interesting business model technology that has been coming out in the last couple of years, aren't they American? So What do you think about entrepreneurship and business dynamism as factors explaining the difference in productivity growth between the EU and the United States?
So this is probably the third driver of innovation. Business dynamism is important for productivity because we want the most productive companies to access labor and capital at the lower possible cost so they can grow, and so the aggregate productivity of the economy will grow as well. And let's assume, well, I think it's fair to say that in the short term, labor and capital are fixed. So there is a specific amount of these two inputs. So the way more productive companies access labor and capital at a lower cost is for lower productivity companies to exit the market and the newly available labor and capital to be redirected to more productive firms. This is called allocative efficiency, and for that you need market competition. Indicators to measure allocative efficiency are hard to find, and they are not produced in ways that is so easily to compare the EU and the US. But we have data for Europe showing that from the financial crisis onwards, the ability of the European economy to allocate labor and capital to its most productive firms had been stalled. But it's not everything bad news for Europe, because there's another driver of productivity, that is trade. Because trade brings competition, and as a result, it incentivizes, encourages companies to become more efficient. And also trade brings new technologies and innovation in the form of foreign goods and services. And in this front, the good news is that Europe is more open to foreign trade and its economy is more intertwined with global value chains than the US. And I think that should be put also on the table. But I don't want to sound overly gloomy, but there are other indicators of international exchange in which the EU is not doing that well. An example, foreign direct investment. It produces similar effects than international trade. It increases competition and provides access to foreign management practices. And when domestic companies invest abroad, it provides access to foreign labor, capital, and also know-how. And if you look at foreign direct investment, the US has attracted more FDI from the rest of the world, and US companies have invested more abroad than European companies during the last 7 years.
All right. Well, that sounds ominous indeed. But if we are going to wrap this up, Oscar, I mean, what would be your main takeaway for Europe and for EU policy? I mean, given the picture that you now painted in terms of productivity performance and varieties between Europe and America, what's important for Europe?
Well, what actually worries me is that the EU is falling behind the US in the new sources of economic growth, which are intangibles. But the good news is that new innovation and technologies, as they digitalize, the EU can focus on diffusion. It doesn't really need to substitute the US, but to complement it. Ideas are non-rival goods. The US economy will benefit from US inventions on AI, and so the EU economy will do. In the same way as all the European countries and the US benefit from technology created in the UK during the Industrial Revolution. But for that, it needs to remain open to these new ideas, to these innovations and these new technologies. And the attention should be placed on connecting the EU with the new sources of technology or these sources of technology and innovation. So the EU economy in ICT, but also in non-digital industries, which are becoming increasingly digitalized, can use these technologies and incorporate it into their products and services. That's the fastest and shortest road to productivity growth and economic prosperity.
All right. And that's, I think, is also a very good note to end our conversation, Oscar. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fredrik.
So that was me, Fredrik Eriksson, talking to my colleague, Oscar Guinea. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the ESIPS Global Economy Podcast. And we are certainly going to return very soon again with more episodes where we track and analyze the direction of the global economy. Thank you so much for listening.